For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Money Succession Recap Podcast, Episode 5. This is when it all goes down. This is the episode we've all been waiting for. I'm kind of incredibly excited to talk about this one. I am Felix Salmon of Axios. I am joined by Emily Peck of The Huffington Post. And this episode is so big and amazing and awesome that we have not one but two special guests. We have, calling in from Reno, Nevada, we have Katie Baker.
I came off a flight from the West Coast for this.
Katie Baker writes for The Ringer and is based in Nevada, or California, actually.
California side.
California side of the California-Nevada border. And notwithstanding the fact that she lives in California, she's come all the way to Brooklyn to be on this show. But we're also joined by Jacob Weisberg of Pushkin Industries, who, notwithstanding the fact that he lives just down the street, is calling in from a remote studio somewhere.
I'm calling you from a WeWork on West 29th Street.
So Jacob used to run this shop, Slate, and has now moved on to grander, podcastier things. But what he still believes in more than anything else is the awesomeness of Succession. So we're going to dive right in here. This, I'm going to say just off the bat, that number one, this was an amazing episode, but number two, the amazingness was not in the Veep-esque lines. This isn't one of those episodes where you're like, I just need to quote the whole show because it was so quotable. Like, this was one of those shows where, like, the things that you picked up on were like, oh my God, Marsha narrowed her eyes.
We should definitely do a deep dive into the Marsha Logan situation, because things got really crazy with Marsha dissing his wine cellar at the dinner. But I feel like first, to me, this episode was a lot about, you know, Siobhan and that promise that was made to her in the first episode that she was the anointed. And this episode makes clear that she is very much not the anointed.
So this was the episode where the MacGuffin finally actually served some purpose. So in episode one, and I remember complaining about this when we did the recap of episode one. In episode one, Logan Roy comes out and says, I'm going to need to name a successor. And everyone kind of looks around as they're watching the show and go, why? Like, why do you need to? And he was like, something, something, proxy war, something. And you're like, okay, but explain why you need a successor. And then that creates the sort of central tension for the whole series, which is who is going to be the successor and whether Siobhan is going to be named as the successor and all of this kind of thing. But in the back of your head, you're like, why does he need to name a successor? And then actually, in this episode, we kind of have a reason why it might be a good idea to have a successor. Because if you have a liberal, young, female successor, that maybe makes it easier for you to buy Pierce. And so now, having number one decided in episode one that he needs a successor, and then number two now has like really good tactical and strategic reasons to name her in public for, you know, various Pierce related reasons, he doesn't do so.
What's up with that, Katie?
What's up with that, Katie?
You can kind of see him, you know, he doesn't want to be told how to do it. And what stuck out to me about this episode and sort of this whole season is the presence of women and so many different women. And, you know, in this episode, there is a scene where I think you see just Jerry and Rhea and Nan Pierce, and they're kind of the, you know, and Naomi next to her, and they're kind of the locus of power. And you think about Logan, who, you know, has already told his own daughter that even if he doesn't believe it, you know, the market won't necessarily want a woman. So for him to be confronted by all these people who are telling him who to pick and what to do. You can just kind of see him refusing to.
So there is this. There is this.
I was really struck by that last scene when it's just like all you have to do is make Siobhan the successor, and it all falls into place. And just on his face, he can't do it. And I was thinking, like, is this about Logan trying to hold on to his power, which he obviously wants to do very much? Or is this about Logan, like, just not getting what he calls the women thing at the beginning of the episode when Shiv says, okay, we'll play good cop, misogynist cop. And he just looks like confused, like, what? And he's, woman thing.
No, but that was it. Like, that's the first time that Logan has been called a misogynist on the show. And in a weird way, and this whole episode is the first time that you get to see that side of him. He's been an equal opportunity arsehole to everyone up until now. But now you're beginning to see, actually, maybe this is, you know, another shitty part of Logan, is he actually does have deep misogynist tendencies and he doesn't want a bunch of women telling him that he has to appoint a woman.
Let them take care of the bottom feeders. We work on Nan.
Uh-huh. Okay. Good cop, misogynist cop?
Sure. You know, the woman thing.
They like
your politics.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I know you don't like the spy.
No, I... Yeah, I can see the logic, you know.
Good.
Anyway, my baby soon.
Well, I do think there's this perception gap between the children and Logan about the succession, in that they think it's fundamentally about which of them, and he thinks it's about whether and when. And basically, he doesn't want to let go, and he realizes as soon as he names any successor, he is diminished and on his way out and will be losing his power. So he just doesn't want to pick a successor. But also, he has fundamental contempt for all of them in different ways, for different reasons, including strong streak of misogyny towards Shiv. But, you know, his sons are basket cases. And he just doesn't want to pick a successor because he thinks he's better at the job than any of them will ever be. And
which
he'll
is
do it when he has
true,
to.
True, right? I mean, he is better at the job than any of them.
And but, he doesn't laugh like a hyena.
But so I go back then, Jacob, to the question I had in episode one, which is, given all that, why did he feel the need to tell Siobhan that she was his chosen one in the first place?
How much of that do you think was him trying to get her off of the campaign? That's what I've kind of always wondered. Like what percentage of it was...
But why did he care that she was on the campaign?
I mean, they had to make a whole deal at the end of last season to, you know, between him and Gil. You know, it just seems like it's kind of one less problem for him if his daughter's not tied up there.
It's a power move for him. He wants her on his side. He doesn't want her out there negotiating against him, essentially, like Katie was saying, blackmailing him at the end of last season.
So the entire, like, in his mind, the whole succession MacGuffin was just basically a way of bringing Shiv back in where he could control her.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's kind of a manipulative sadist, right? I mean, the idea of pitting the three children against each other and giving them all false expectations and then watching them go at each other like scorpions is appealing to him.
Yeah, he likes that. But can we talk a little snitch more about the misogyny? Because, again, I have to come back to Marcia at the dinner. So the Pierces and the Roys sit down to this dinner. I mean...
What a dinner.
And Nan Pierce turns to Marcia and she asks like something innocuous, like, where are you from or something? And she says Beirut, right?
So Nan turns to Marcia and says, so I hear you grew up in Beirut.
Yeah.
And then Logan immediately like jumps in.
Won't even let her answer the question. And just Nan's face, this she's a brilliant actress. I think she comes from Broadway. Just brilliant.
Cherry Jones.
And she also played the president in one season of 24, which is where I know her from. You know, she just has this look on her face of just like total understanding, watching Logan answer for his wife. And then Marcia sort of like stepping up and getting a little huffy with him, you know, right? Where he says, oh, she told me her life story in one night. And Marcia's like, if you gave me a whole year, I couldn't tell you my life story. And it becomes this really interesting window into their relationship. And you see Marcia throughout the episode getting increasingly agitated with Logan and being looped out of everything, right?
It's super interesting. She like locks the door behind the rest of the family and then like gives him one barrel and storms off into the bathroom. And And this is the first indication that there's any tension between them. Mm-hmm. Like, she has always been super supportive, and we've always assumed that she's had all manner of ulterior motives. But now, for some reason, things are coming out in a kind of bad way. I mean, the big arc of this episode, we should zoom out a little bit, is that Logan has this idea that the family is going to alight at Turnhaven and, like, charm the Pierces into selling their company to, and, like, of all the families to enter upon a charm offensive, like, Logan is surely bright enough to realize that this particular group of misfits would never charm anyone into anything. But he seems to think that's possible. And he gets angry when the kids turn out not to be very charming, which everyone knew that they wouldn't be. But the one person who kind of knows what she's doing is Marcia, right? Marcia is like the old world connection. And she kind of, on some level, speaks the Pierce language in the way that none of the Logans do.
And Nan loves that she's not a trophy wife.
Yes,
she remarks at some point, this isn't the typical second wife that a man in your position chooses.
Yeah, it was interesting. I thought that was interesting that I think it was tactical by Nan, but that the credit there is accruing to Logan, you know, after he gets kind of upbraided by her and snaps at her at the dinner table. I mean, that was a moment where you just can feel being in that room and that tension after mm-hmm.
But I think that was part of, like, why the whole misogyny thing came as a little bit of a surprise, just because, you know, the casting of Marcia and the age-appropriate second wife and everything kind of implies that maybe he's slightly woker than that, and he didn't choose a trophy wife. And now we discover that, you know, she's someone who actually prefers, you know, French wine, not that she would ever tell him.
Another glass for both of you?
Well, no, we tend to kind of keep it to...
Yes, thank you.
Excuse me?
His cellar is all new world, and it doesn't suit me.
Why didn't you say?
It suits you, so it can suit me. See? I'm not a difficult person.
So, Jacob, I need to ask you, because, you know, you're my wine geekiest of guests. What do you think the wine that Nan Pierce was serving was? What do you think was that wine that Marcia wanted a second helping of?
Well, Logan clearly pours Australian wine at in his cellar.
No, I think it's California. I think Logan pours Screaming Eagle.
Yeah, no, I think that was
or
a burgundy.
Opus 1.
I think we got a little glimpse of the shape of the bottle, and it looked like a burgundy to me. And
I
thought of you at that moment, and I was totally on her side. But also, Felix, I think this is the key to the episode in a funny way, because the Pierce family is the mirror of the Roy family. They have different values. They have a different style. They're much classier. They're old wasps. They drink French wine instead of California wine. They value, you know, PhDs instead of trophy apartments. But they're just as fucking greedy.
Yep.
And as weird.
That's the ultimate lesson. Just take the fucking money.
And they're also, like, unspeakable. I mean, they're dreadful people.
I mean, I thought the interaction between Naomi and Kendall really kind of showed what Jacob is talking about a little bit. Like, at the end of the day, at first it seems like Naomi's kind of his better, you know, she's working in a rehab and she's also getting her treatment there, and she seems to really have her shit together. But then, you know, by the end of the dinner, she is asking him to do drugs together, and they're sitting in that helicopter drinking a bottle of vodka and just getting utterly shit-faced. And they're basically the same creature, you know, stripped away of the Shakespeare quotes. It's the same thing.
So, I mean, the way I see this episode being constructed is that you have this, like, ludicrous plan by Logan to charm the Pierces. It all goes spectacularly pear-shaped in this dinner, which is, you know, the most gloriously constructed dinner in the history of Succession, I think. It's really well done. So you get this horrible dinner. But then somehow, improbably, that disaster turns into success. It turns out that the very disaster of the dinner means that Naomi and Kendall can wind up, like, getting shit-faced together. It means that Siobhan winds up blurting out the fact that she's going to be the next CEO, which is kind of the one thing that maybe tips it over in, you know, for Nan to say, well, if Siobhan can take over, then I might be okay with this, you know. And then once Nan, like, mentally is like, I can be okay with this if Siobhan's going to be the successor, then she's kind of mentally made that decision. And then, you know, Naomi comes on board thanks to her, you know, torrid whatever it is that she did with Kendall. And then once you've made a decision, you can't kind of go back on it because you've basically mentally pocketed that $25 billion. And so even when you don't really come to an agreement in the room, by the time they leave on their helicopters, you're like, well, I can't give up this $25 billion that I've mentally accepted. And so they wind up taking it.
Well, and they squeeze them for one last billion. But also, you know, what saves the deal is the children going off script and ignoring Logan. It's Shiv, you know, trying this sort of dinner coup where she says, I'm the successor, and announces it. But then it's the scene in the helicopter when Kendall, who Logan has explicitly instructed stay clean, convinces Naomi, who is the one who has come in from California to block the deal, that take the money and run, right? So it's those two things that cause the deal to happen, which otherwise wouldn't have.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So can we talk about the hypocrisy of the Pierces? Because that's the other sort of running theme is, you know, that wonderful speech that Nan gives about how money is a social construct, but virtue and integrity actually exist.
Harry,
and,
you know, yes,
and that whole thing where, like, is it Naomi who, you know, who starts quoting Richard II in order mm-hmm. to show how, like, high-minded they all are?
Mm-hmm. Well, and then,
is that a little bit thin? Is that just a little bit too easy on the part of the succession writers here that you just have these, you know, this veneer of waspy respectability, but really they're all just greedy folks?
I mean, I think it's very accurate. What really stuck out to me about this episode is, you know, as we talked about, you kind of have these bizarro versions of each other. Them walking toward each other from the helicopter was like the Seinfeld.
Such a great,
I mean,
such
it
a
was
great shot.
So funny. And Papa Smurf holding hands. But but I just thought the details were so, it just really showed the different kinds of money. And the, you know, you have Nan, who's just, I have a friend whose mom is Nan Pierce, you know, and she would say, I don't want to interrupt your tipple. Welcome to our funny little house. Mm-hmm. Those little details I thought were like so on point. And I was looking up who wrote this episode, and it's Will Tracy, who used to work for The Onion and for John Oliver. And so, you know, he's obviously someone with a good eye for that kind of detail.
Jacob, you're the most, you know, what's the word, well-connected among us here. Was this realistic in terms of its depiction of rich American WASP?
No. In particular, I don't think the dinner was realistic. But interestingly, we've had two episodes out of five so far built around dinners. Elaborately at a table. So, you know, we have to look at those in relation to each other. But I've actually had the feeling with both of them that they were just fundamentally implausible, you know, that at this dinner where these people have never met, that, you know, they'd be talking about not having sex in their relationship with Roman and, you know, just the things that came out of their mouths at the various points in the dinner as well as the cult scene, just seemed a little pushed beyond reality
to me.
But
that's the Roys. I have one kind of logistical trivial concern, which is when Nan brings out the roast and she just puts it on the table.
And curtsies.
I don't know. Yeah. What? And they all applaud the roast.
That, yeah.
How do they eat the roast? First of all, was that roast big enough for all those people? I don't think so. Second of all, who's cutting the roast and how is it getting passed around? And why? I do not move in WASPy elite circles, but like, why are they putting the roasting pan on the table? That just seems all wrong.
It felt wrong, but it felt to me like it was WASP theater. There's something about, like, Logan would never pretend to do his own cooking.
Right, never.
But Nan actually wants to pretend to do her
own
cooking.
And wants to try to tell her housekeeper to treat
her.
You never treat yourself.
Remember, she asked the chef to have her, the housekeeper to have a drink with him. So part of their pretense is that the servants aren't servants. They're really members of the family.
But you saw the woman when she did the roast handoff kind of have this look on her face like, what a load of bullshit this is. I made this roast and she's getting all the praise for it. I felt right. that.
There's one thing I want to bring up, you know, I'm sure we'll get to kind of who these families are.
Let's do that now. Yeah, are these families, Gaby?
Let me just put it this way. I looked up the Bancroft Wikipedia page, and it includes this quote. The family members' private pastimes consist mainly of show horse breeding, sailing, and farming. However, the family has also produced a speedboat champion and an airline pilot. I love the however, by the way. As absurd as a lot of these details are, there's some kind of, you know, weird people out there.
So, Jacob, what do you think? Bancrofts or Salzburgers?
Oh, God, Bancrofts. I mean, they're real WASPs, not semi-Jews. But also, you know, the story is exactly what happened with Murdoch and the Journal, at least as I remember it. The Bancroft family was really divided about whether to sell and resisted, and then agreed on the understanding that they had, quote, ironclad protections for the journalism, you know, which were worth the Kleenex they were printed on when Murdoch got control and immediately fired the editor. But I think none of this is modeled 100%, but the scenario is Murdoch buying the Journal.
The Bancrofts put up at least a semblance of a fight. I mean, the Pierces, we didn't really even, the only Pierce who seemed to be opposed for about a millisecond was Naomi, and then all she needs is a glug of vodka and a couple of lines of coke, and even she gets persuaded.
That seemed highly unbelievable, right? I mean, his pitch was just like, you can have a lot of money and start over. That just didn't seem, what is she doing with the company now that's so taxing on her? It's not like she has the mirror of his experience with Logan.
She would stop being in the tabloids if she got in another, you know, femur-breaking car crash.
Right.
Yeah.
I was not convinced by his pitch at all.
Yeah. I think what bothered me the most was just – I think I get the reason for it, and I think the reason is just to show that kind of money wins and Logan wins again, but the whiplash of being on the helicopter and him slamming the window in frustration, and then 10 seconds later...
No, I thought he slammed the window in victory because he just got the email.
Jerry shook her head. No, he hadn't gotten it yet.
Oh.
And he was so mad, and then they land, and then maybe they get signal when they land or something, but... I just thought it was a little too off screen, this huge change, you know, a 180 change in the decision. But I guess that's what happens when you're willing to walk away from the deal.
That was his plan.
He gave them almost everything they wanted. The only thing he didn't give them was like the Shiv thing.
Was his daughter.
He gave away Tom. It was like, that's not a problem. Poor Tom. Let's talk about Tom for a second.
Oh my God. Let's talk about Tom, because that is one of my favorite lines, is like when all of the focus comes to Tom and they're like, wait, Tom, are you going to be in charge of all of our news organizations? Are you going to be the guy in whom like the precious editorial independence of Pierce is entrusted? And his immortal line really settling this question once and for all is, the king of edible leaves, His Majesty the Spinach.
I feel like that probably really appealed to the Pierces. Probably like we're really in on that vibe. You know what I mean?
Virtue, integrity, these things actually exist.
Well, because this morning I went to the store and I bought a pound of ham and I pay for it by, you know, telling them I was really worried about the environment.
Don't mind Tom. He finds other people's integrity a personal affront for some reason.
Well, yes, that's thank you. I'm a piece of dirt.
Oh,
yep. I'll take it.
But Tom, if there was an acquisition, then as head of news, you would be the guy in charge of our crown jewels, right?
Oh, well, we'd have to see about that.
Ooh, hear that, Tom? Sounds dicey. Got a pitch?
Tom, everything rests on what you're about to say.
Oh, lay off.
Oh, wait a minute, though. I didn't hear. So would he stay on as the head of news?
Ooh, king of edible leaves, His Majesty the Spinach.
I feel like that's the one thing these families agreed on was just like, Tom is awful. And his own wife is right there with him. They go out and have that the conversation ostensibly about the dog. They're really just freaking out together. And is that when he says to her, like, you could be nicer to me? And she's like, why? You say dumb things. And his face just looks like defeated. Just so sad. Like, his wife is not on his side. No one is on Tom's side. But he is very much on Shiv's side. He, like, builds her back up. He says to her, you are at the table. And I feel like he gives her the confidence to then go in and say she's the next, you know, CEO and kind of, like, screws herself but enables the deal.
I'm not. Well, he's been told that his role there is to have the shit beat out of him,
yes,
and take it, and
yes,
then he's attacked by everyone for being weak.
I mean, to your point, Jacob, about like the big dinner scenes, he got like 1% of the shit beat out of him in this dinner than he did in the last dinner.
Mm, that's true.
The one where he's kind of stood back up to Shiv.
Yes.
Which sort of carried over into this episode in the way that Shiv is starting to get called out on a lot of things. Like, she makes a joke and everyone's like, that's not funny, Shiv. You know, whereas last season she was kind of had the swagger, and you can really see that it's been drained from her. Like, even I thought the way they film her with her face, she looks so pale and just so different from, you know, when she's striding around even in episode one.
So I mean, this is the whole, there was a big piece in
Logan
Vox.
Did that to her. That's what Logan did to her, and that's what Logan did to some extent to Kendall also. He brings you in closer and strips you away of all your power so he can
and,
have power
and your
over
self-respect
you.
Because they all, like, basically the closer you are to Logan, the more you hate yourself.
Yes.
It really is. It's funny because there's a lot of lines in the show where they talk about, like, Logan in, like, a sexual way. They'll be like, dad really bent over for this or something. And you're like, whoa. But there is this weird, like, relationship with him and his kids. Like, I felt it with Shiv in episode one, where it felt like someone who is, you know, in a relationship kind of has the upper hand and then shows the vulnerability and then it all changes. And he really, like, treats it almost like that. It's like a you know, people trying to break up and he won't let them break up and he brings them closer. And
they're all desperate to please him. I mean, you know, Shiv says in that scene where she steps out with Tom, I'm not even in favor of this and I'm desperate to get it. And Kendall had just said in the previous episode, basically, the only reason I'm not killing myself is because I'm useful to my dad. That's the only thing that gives my life meaning right now. Right.
Oh,
so the children are still absolutely desperate to please him, even as they get what he's doing. The funny thing about Tom is that he's so clueless, he can't even perceive between Logan's real bullying, as in the boar on the floor scene, and his pretend bullying at this dinner. He experiences it all the same way.
Speaking of, there was this sort of like sad little scene at the top of the episode where Logan actually pays attention to Roman and says he's proud of him for going to management training. And you can see Roman's so happy that his dad's paying attention and is proud of him. Then he immediately undercuts it and is like, don't talk about that, though, because it's like you're in kindergarten. So and he's like, thanks, dad. There's a lot of just scenes where it's like, this could be the dad. This could be the great dad. Like, Logan gives a toast when they all get to Haven, you know, the house in the Hamptons, and he gives this really lovely toast. And Connor, he like makes this aside, and he's like, "I like this dad. Why couldn't this dad be dad?" You know, like everyone just wants.
Line.
Yeah, everyone just wants Logan to be a nice. Can't he just be a nice dad? You know, that's really what it's all about.
So I do need to come back because as regular listeners of the Slate Money Succession podcast will know I am obsessed with Marcia. I do want to just spend a minute talking about Marcia. What do we think? Like, we have like the bit where she like when Logan at the very beginning says that he and Rhea are gonna, you know, be a team. And Shiv says out loud, like, wait, why? You know, I thought she was the CEO of the rival company. But it's Marsha who, like, we get the cut away and she's, like, narrowing her eyes. Like, Marsha is clearly upset about something here. And there's tensions between them. And she'd much rather kind of, she seems to be happier in the Pierce house drinking the Romane Conte than in the Logan house drinking the Screaming Eagle. I don't know. Like, what do we think is going on there?
I mean, what is Marsha's endgame? I thought she is upset lately because she feels like she doesn't have, she's not Logan's. She's just like another child. She's not Logan's number one. You know, he doesn't confide in her. He snaps at her at the dinner because she says, like, as an aside, like, is that true about, you know, Shiv? And he kind of tells her to shut up or whatever he says. Like, she wants to be his confidant and he has shut her out. And that's the source of her anger.
Maybe that's
a generous view. Maybe she has some other thing going on. I don't know. What do you think, Jacob?
Well, I think the show is about power, and her power is exercised through Logan. So the succession is threatening to her as well, right? And I think she maybe perceives in Rhea someone who actually would be capable of running the company, who's a woman who Logan likes and actually respects. So if you play out the scenario, you know, what happens? They throw Tom out. Rhea is in charge of the news business and then maybe runs the whole company. I mean, she's sort of the only person around the table who actually could do that job.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm just okay. I think there may be some little seeds planted to this, but I agree that we're going to see the Marsha plot is surely going to develop, right? She's just kind of bubbling, you know, and in this episode, we saw her kind of with this kind of explosive moment. So we see that there's something going on there. But we don't quite, it hasn't been quite explained what she wants to happen or what she's trying to prevent or what her stakes are exactly.
So do you think there's a scenario in which, like, Marsha teams up with siblings to do something, take power from Logan? Is anyone ever going to take power from Logan?
And Shiv all coming together in some kind of, like, matriarchal overthrow?
Yeah. Is there any room for a matriarchal overthrow or at least a power grab from Logan? I mean, Kendall made his weak attempts last season, obviously, and now is a destroyed human being who poops in the bed. But is there anyone else who could do a Kendall in a bed and do it right?
Right. I think if you get Shiv and Rhea and Nan and Jerry and all of the actually competent women together, Maybe they, in if they combine their forces and fight Thanos, they can win.
So one thing,
except they don't have the goal of advancing women. They're all out for themselves, right?
Yep.
So any alliances they make will be merely tactical as ways of winning themselves individually.
One thing I was trying to think about is how, you know, we've kind of seen the Kendall arc. We're in the middle of the Shiv arc, so to me, there's going to be kind of a more concentrated Roman at some point. Then I start to wonder, to what extent is Jerry going to maybe become, you know, the Rasputin, the, you know, she already...
Oh, my God. So basically, Roman is going to become Jerry's puppet?
I hope so.
I mean, that's what's happening right now, right? I mean,
she really is dangling him on the end of her strings and he's doing whatever she says. And oh, my God, Jerry's control over Roman is something to behold.
And at the same time, she's kind of getting, there's been a few points this season, including last night, where she's getting kind of like Logan's giving her a hard time at the table. He says, well, technically, you know, Jerry's on the document as a placeholder, but we all know she couldn't do the job. Or she'd be
she'd be the first to say that she couldn't do the job. And she's like, maybe the second.
You know, she's so good. But and there was another moment, I think, in maybe episode one when he was giving his big succession speech. And so, you know, it's almost like they're planting the seeds of her to start feeling a little bit of wanting to push back. I mean, I don't know. I'm just spitballing here, but
I don't think any of the people that surround Logan have it in them to push back. I think they're all, in order to stay with someone like that, you have to let go of all your self-esteem,
except all your
stuff.
Conceivably,
pride.
Rhea.
Yeah, I love when he says, "Why wasn't I told of this?" And she says, first of all, not my fucking job. That was one of my favorite lines.
Yeah, that was good. Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need.
The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Okay, so let's do some favorite lines. Katie Baker, what was your favorite line?
All right.
This episode.
Mine is Queen Nan when she says, "I'm afraid we've gone so Unitarian out here that we've given up on poor Jesus and started worshiping Shakespeare." And one thing I loved about the scene, you know, at the end when Logan says, "You want to know my Shakespeare," is what's funny is Brian Cox is like a noted Shakespearean actor. So I kind of was imagining this. He was about to like
launch
blow them away with
some
Hamlet.
Coriolanus.
Yeah. And instead it was the exact opposite.
Would you like to hear my favorite passage from Shakespeare? Take the fucking money.
I think my favorite line is, "I got tipsy and I offered him the State Department."
Oh, you stole mine, Felix, but it was
I got in there before you.
And I offered him the State Department.
Connor was kind of adorable. Like, this was the first episode where I was like, all right, Connor, I see what you're doing.
You've got
really? I don't mind
what's
you.
What's he doing?
Well, he got tipsy. I just like that he said that particular line was rather charming. And then when he just said that aside about his father, I don't know. He was all of a sudden a little more human than usual to me. But my favorite line was said by Tom to Shiv after that crazy dinner. He said, "Jeepers fucking creepers, what a shit pinata. That was like the most Roy thing I have ever seen. It was like I got a quart of Roy injected into my eyeballs." It was the best little dialogue ever. And then she just is like, "Yeah, I guess." And then she says, "Is there booze?" And he says, "Are you kidding? It's just Emily Dickinson in low thread count sheets." I just love that whole scene so much. Oh,
we've all slept in one of those low thread count twin beds at someone's funny little house.
With the brake bumper.
Oh, yeah.
Recipe from Teddy Roosevelt's valet. So apologies for stealing your line, Jacob, but do you have a backup?
Here's a backup. Well, I guess it would have been when Naomi said, "Would you like to take illegal drugs with me?" it's on both their minds, and he says, "Are you going to say it?" And that's her line. And that's sort of the hinge moment in the episode, right, when suddenly you realize that they're completely on the same wavelength.
There's a couple of hinges, right, because when they get off the helicopters, there's this, like, very long extended hug between Naomi and her ex-girlfriend, and you're like, oh, we can see who she's going to hook up with. And then she, you know, that was all, like, misdirection.
Do they hook up? Did Kendall and
Well, there was definitely a snog.
Right. But I didn't understand why he... We don't have to talk about it if you don't want to. But I don't understand why he was naked in the bed. Like, that was just... He just got so...
I think that was just... They really wanted to, you know, push that whole, like, shitting the bed metaphor and make it as literal as they possibly could.
Yeah, the question is, like, did she leave the bed or did he stumble back to the bed? I think it was probably the latter, but... Or they probably would have, like, made it more clear that she had, like... been there for
I think it ended with the snog.
Okay, yeah, and I guess it's just continuing Succession's streak of not having anyone ever have sex.
Correct. No one ever has sex
beyond
on this
Roman.
Show.
I spoke with one of the writers about this a little bit. She was saying that that's like a very deliberate choice. And, you know, as she put it, they don't, this is Lucy Preble, one of the writers, they don't want to show just like tits and ass, which is, you know, on HBO, that's, there are many other shows that are, have an opposite ethos.
Yeah.
But she said that, you know, that when it advances the story, so something like the Roman Jerry is really important to them because they think it, you know, it's very true as to how his sort of psychosexual demeanor might be, you know, as the guy he is.
Wait, and now that you talk about nudity, I think I've only seen, I've seen Kendall naked. I don't think I've seen any women naked on this show. It's men who get naked.
I don't know. I mean, like,
that must be deliberate too.
The latest sex scene we have is like two people in their jammies, right?
I love Jerry's jammies.
Oh, Jerry's pajamas are awesome. Like, yeah, it's just, it's all part of the general Jerry fan club.
Yes, I'm here for
it. I'm waiting for the, you know, the mean and ruthless side of Jerry to come out, because right now she's too sympathetic, and you can't be too sympathetic on this show without someone coming out and making you less sympathetic.
Speaking of which, great moment where Roman just comes out and says what happened at the at the buffet line, and everyone, no one even reacts, because it's something he would say.
Well, that harkens back to, he's reading the Latin on the wall. Help me out.
Oh my God. Like, and he's like, truth in my vagina.
Vagina trumpets.
Yes.
But it was like, and truth the, is and, everything and or
the
something.
Pierce, and then there's that like humorless Pierce who like, you know, actuallys him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the Pierces. Who do we like better, the Pierces or the Roys?
Well, that's a good question.
I would hang with Nan and Naomi for, you know, a real late night. I don't know about any of the men of the Pierce family. Zero.
Oh yeah, the Pierce men would like, terrible. They were terrible. Jacob, Pierces or Roys? If you had to choose.
I think I'm having dinner with the Roys. It's way more fun. You know, the Pierces, you've got to apologize to for making a joke about the dude's second PhD. It was a pretty good joke, too.
That's a good joke.
Yeah, I'm actually getting my second PhD right now in Africana studies from Brown.
Wow, so you'd be a double doctor?
Well, the second PhD is much harder. Yeah, 5 years is an absolute gauntlet.
Oh, I'm sure. But just think, you know, once you're done, you won't have to waste the 12 seconds it takes to look up something on Wikipedia.
I would be very intrigued to crack the case that is Marnie Pierce. And really, see, we need to get Kendall to see if we can get her, you know, off her rocker. She's kind of the...
Wait, school, which one is mine?
She's like the school marmish one who's like looking up horrible, Electric Circus on her phone.
Oh my God, when Roman is desperately trying to show
he
that he's read
book.
A book.
Yes.
That reminded me of the scene in Almost Famous where they're like, it's a think piece. Like, he's like, the circus is a metaphor for the anxiety of modern life.
And she's like, can I find it on Amazon? He's like, no. No, this is a book which was just written for me.
But yeah, I mean, I did kind of think I'd much rather hang out, you know, in general, the Roy family, even though they're terrible, they'd probably be more fun in a weird way. I don't know. Is Shiv fun?
No, they're all terrifying. And I would never sit down at a table with them because I would come away feeling just crushed because they are devastatingly critical of everyone they come in contact with.
I continue to just wonder, like, who are Shiv's friends?
Also, they hate you.
Yeah, like, exactly. They hate everyone.
They hate everyone. I mean, what's that wonderful line at the very beginning of the episode where Roman comes in from his management training? He's like, I no longer speak 1%. And you're like, yeah, because the thing that we have in common and that keeps us together is our utter contempt for anyone who's not us.
Yeah. Once again, there, you know, kind of as in the first episode, you saw the scene of like food being prepared by the help. And, you know, it's not a show that's going to suddenly have a bottle episode from inside the mind of the help. You know, that it's almost, or maybe it will, but it almost seems purposely designed to show that they're just in their bubble, as Marcia called it, in their playground, and they think it's the world, and they don't. The show doesn't show like anyone else point of view unless it's working for the Roys.
So I have a question, Jacob, about Logan Roy's ideology, that it's very clear what the tension is on the part of the Pierce family. That on the one hand, we want $25 billion. On the other hand, you know, we have this public trust. And there's definitely this kind of thread of Kay Graham running through Nan Pierce. And, you know, we are trying to uphold truth and democracy. And there's a little part of me which believes that we caused the fall of the Berlin Wall and all of this kind of thing, right? And they want to preserve that. And it's part of their self-mythos. It's part of what they believe about themselves, is that they, you know, they're very important parts of democracy. Is that something that Logan naturally would destroy because he kind of cares about just making, about dumbing down the news and making it as, you know, stupid as possible? Or does he really not care about that and he'd be perfectly happy to have that as part of his empire?
It's not his agenda at the moment, right? Because right now he's just trying to save his company and he just has to eat this smaller fish to save himself, to feed himself. But he knows down the road, he's happy to say whatever because it won't mean a thing. And yeah, probably his agenda at the moment is not politics, but at some point he'll want to throw aside their values in pursuit of his vision of what news organizations should do, which is, you know, the ticker on Fox News.
You know, Murdoch, I mean, he did not keep his promises a lot with the Wall Street Journal. But today, the Wall Street Journal on the news side is still a respectable product.
And on the opinion side, it was never respectable.
Right. It was never respectable. That wasn't an issue at all. And I mean, he's tinkered a lot with the paper. He made the A-head shorter. You know, he made the news story shorter. He did a lot of stuff, no doubt. But like at the end of the day, they did actually maintain their editorial
integrity. Jacob, this is a question which you might be able to answer. Is the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal was complete wingnut, even under the Bancrofts, who owned it and controlled it? Like, was that because the Bancrofts on some point, at some level, were actually like wingnut Republicans?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think they were responsible for that editorial page. That wasn't Murdoch. But Murdoch did, you know, not only did he push aside the controls he agreed to and fire the editor, who was Marcus Broccoli, you know, he put in these series of News Corp loyalists, Robert Thompson, and then Gerald Baker, you know, and I do think, I mean, I think in one sense, the journalism has held up very well. On the other hand, I don't think it's trusted, nor do I trust it under Murdoch ownership the way, you know, I think it was had genuine independence before he bought
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah.
So Rupert Murdoch owns The Sun in the UK, which is the biggest selling newspaper in the UK. And in the middle of all of this Brexit chaos, which we don't need to go into, the front page of The Sun was a picture of Jeremy Corbyn, who's the leader of the opposition, with the headline, "Is this the most dangerous chicken in Britain?" And everyone's sort of like, oh, that's very Murdoch, and he's like being very political. And what no one realized was that there's this Scottish version of The Sun, which only comes out in Scotland. And the front page of the Scottish Sun was, "Floppy Johnson can't get an election." And I think what that just goes to prove, certainly for Murdoch, but I think also for Logan, is that, yeah, you know, I'm not ideological. You know, I am going to give my readers what they want. You know, even if it's the same paper in two different nations. And I feel like on some level, Logan's happy to give the PSs their editorial independence because he doesn't actually care about it that much.
Yeah. I have one more footnote for you, Felix. The book Roman was referring to, I think, is a real book that he really read. And I think it's Jennifer Egan's The Invisible Circus, which I read a long time ago, but I vaguely remember what he said about it was accurate in that it's about a family and it takes place in two different time periods.
Oh, wow.
And it's like a thing about two sisters, and the one's going back to figure out why the other one committed suicide. And I think it's a little bit of probably a joke of the screenwriters, but I think he wasn't bullshitting. He just had it a little wrong.
Succession screenwriters joined me in the Jennifer Egan hive. I love it.
That's awesome. Okay, so yeah, is there anywhere for this season to go? I mean, this is also what happened in season one, right? Is that you get this big question, like, you know, which then gets resolved in like episode 4 or episode 5. And you're like, what happens now? And like the big question was like, is he going to be able to buy Pierce, the great white whale? And now he seems to have bought Pierce. And,
right.
You know, cousin Greg is turning up with champagne.
Oh, my God.
Gregory.
What has happened to Gregory?
Promoted because he wound up blackmailing. So now he's Gregory.
He comes in and he has that move where he kind of like takes his glove off and he looks. I mean, it's.
That's what happens when you wake up in that apartment every day. It changes you, you know?
I can't wait to see what else Gregory has up his sleeve.
Yeah. Oh, my God. You guys, you did it. Yeah, congratulations.
Hey. Thanks, man.
Hey. Yeah.
Hello, Greg.
I'm actually going by Gregory now. Okay. But, yeah, no matter. Thank you, Richard. Wow, how are you, Marcia?
Good, thanks.
And how was it? Was it awesome? Or?
Yeah, it was eventful.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. Nice of you to come by, man.
No worries. This is huge for us. And this like saves us maybe from the takeover.
Greg.
Hey, Gregory.
Have a drink, have a drink, you beautiful Ichabod Crane, fuck you.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, I gotta say, well done. You won.
Yeah? Yeah. Money wins. Here's to us.
Here to us.
That scene, the way it ended after that Gregory scene, it was so just devastating. The toast, and then Logan immediately just puts his drink down, turns away, and goes up the stairs. And that's the celebration of the family, and everyone's just sitting there, hating life. Quite the ending. But it did feel almost like a little bit of a mid-season, not finale, but it seems like there's going to be a whole next cycle of story.
Yeah, we're exactly halfway through, right?
Yeah. All right. See you next week.
See you next week on Slate Money Succession.